Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
$4 million. That's the estimation for the value of the total gifts that one Supreme Court justice, one Justice Clarence Thomas, has received from deep-pocketed conservatives. Now, those gifts were not disclosed until they were found out, and then some of them were subsequently disclosed, and then we found out some more, and so who knows if the value is even greater than that. But that's what we know of. So why is this problematic? I want you to think about this. It's not just that people like Harlan Crow, a billionaire with conservative interests, was giving a lot of these gifts. It's that these gifts gave access. You had people like Leonard Leo, who helped architect the rightward shift of the entire judiciary, a very political actor, who was sitting next to Clarence Thomas or going fishing with him or doing all the things that they were doing on these luxury trips. It was having an influence in the court. And that's what is one of the problems. That's why people, including me, are losing faith in the court as an institution, as a fair arbiter of the biggest issues that we face. So how do we get more accountability? How do we get ethics at the U.S. Supreme Court? I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is Justice by Design, where we talk about the biggest issues facing our society and the solutions for fixing them. And when it comes to fixing the court, there's nobody more qualified to talk about that than Gabe Roth of Fix the Court. Gabe, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So give our listeners a little bit of an intro of who you are and what you do.
Sure. So Fix the Court is my organization. I started it in 2014 to advocate for solutions to the lack of transparency and accountability in the Supreme Court and really all the federal judiciary, everything from live streaming to term limits to ethics reform, disclosure reform, recusal reform, learning more about their public appearances and entanglements. My background is actually in broadcast journalism. I went to J School for grad school and worked in local news in Florida for a bit, moved up to D.C. and switched over from journalism to political consulting pretty quickly. And some of the clients that I had ended up having cases in the federal courts. So these were marriage plaintiffs, voting rights plaintiffs, DACA recipients, and they're in Texas and Maine and California. They're like, we could just watch our cases when they reach SCOTUS on C-SPAN 4, which of course is not a thing. So I started a group called the Coalition for Court Transparency in 2012 to try to get cameras or live streaming in the Supreme Court, which we finally got live audio at least in 2020. But doing events with this coalition, I realized that it wasn't just the cameras issue that made the Supreme Court so opaque and so antediluvian. Was the ethics issues and the term issues that I mentioned. So then I started Fix the Court a couple years later, and now I feel like we're sort of at a moment where these changes are now being talked about in a more serious and full-throated fashion nationwide.
So I want you to frame the problems with the court as you see it. I mean, I just highlighted one issue, which is a different form of lack of transparency, not disclosing gifts, not just for the sake of the gifts. I don't care how much money a Supreme Court justice has. I care about the source and the reason. But what besides that, or including that, you can include that, do you see the current, how do you see the court currently as broken?
So I think to answer your question, this is happening on two different planes. One is from the Supreme Court's decisions itself. People are losing trust in the court, given the speed at which they are overturning precedent, whether it be on reproductive rights, affirmative action, how the administrative state works. There are a lot of decisions where, to paraphrase a Justice Breyer quote from a while ago, so much is happening so fast. So I think that that's definitely, you know, it's not necessarily something that my group deals with. We don't really get into the nitty gritty of the decisions, because frankly, there are other groups that are better suited to talk about things like choice and affirmative action, talking to a, you know, someone that that doesn't affect directly usually. Yeah. You know, that being said, there is this other plane that I work on, which is the oversight of the institutional practices. And there really is none in terms of oversight, right? A justice can err, a justice can fail to recuse, and there's no recourse or reprimand save the high bar of impeachment. And no justice has ever been impeached and removed from the Supreme Court. So, but that doesn't mean that we can't do nothing, or that we're forced to feel like we can't do anything. There are things that we can do to make the Supreme Court more open, more accountable. And if we don't, if we are just sort of stay where we are, then I think this erosion of trust in the judiciary and its legitimacy is going to continue to only grow.
Okay. I want to get to the things that we can do, but I want to drill down just a little more, because I think this is something that really surprises people. And no matter how many times I write about it or I talk about it on TV or another podcast, people still don't get this. So there is a law, there is by federal law requirements, certain requirements that the Supreme Court do things in order to avoid a conflict of interest. Every federal judge is subject to this law, including the Supreme Court. So why, when it comes to the Supreme Court justices, is there a different outcome than, say, for a federal appellate judge or a federal trial judge, something many of these justices have been before,
yes,
so they know how to do this.
Yeah.
So why is it a different outcome for them than it is for other federal judges?
I mean, there are a couple of reasons. I mean, there's no good reason, but here are the reasons that this exists. One is theoretically that anything that happens in a lower federal court, whether it be just a run-of-the-mill decision or some ethics issue, could one day be adjudicated or reviewed by the Supreme Court. So that gives you a little more leeway of understanding, okay, a federal trial judge, a federal bankruptcy judge, a federal appeals court judge does something bad, then down the line, there is someone above them, SCOTUS, that could then, you know, fix it theoretically. The other thing is separation of powers, which is sort of, you know, to paraphrase a famous Justice Thomas quote, Justice Thomas once said, stare decisis is what people cite when they don't want to think, right? They'll just do what they did in the past is what his view of stare decisis is, which is depressing. But, you know, separation of powers is what a lot of people in this realm say when they don't want to think, when they don't want to do anything. There are separation of powers concerns generally when you're talking about Congress getting involved in the work of the court, in that when Mississippi and Tennessee have a fight over the water that runs under Memphis in the Mississippi River,
right,
and there's something called the original jurisdiction docket, it is in the Constitution that that case has to go to the Supreme Court on first instance. That's in the Constitution, right? So there, you know, so Congress can't step in and say, hey, Mississippi, you get, you know, we're giving you this amount of groundwater, and Tennessee, we're giving you this amount of groundwater. No, the original jurisdiction goes, right? So there are separation of powers concerns within the confines of the Constitution. However, those don't really exist with the institutional practices of the court. So long as you're not diminishing the justices' salaries or kicking certain justices off of certain percentage of cases or taking away their original jurisdiction, Congress can pretty much do what it wants when it comes to the institutional practices of the courts. And that has itself been upheld by the Supreme Court in countless of instances in the last 230 years. That being said, Congress is one branch, the court is the head of another branch, they're supposed to be separate, there is a principle of judicial independence, people get nervous, not reasonably, but regardless, people get nervous when you start saying, oh, we want to change this or that about the court, as if it hasn't happened in the past, and as if this sort of blanket separation of powers should trump everything, when in reality it shouldn't.
Yeah, and you add to that, Gabe, the idea that the Supreme Court seems completely allergic to the idea of policing itself, which is also a principle, right? There's this idea that as the top jurists in the nation, that who better knows how to enforce ethics rules, even by themselves, on themselves than the Supreme Court. And so it's been left to them in terms of enforcement. They're still bound by these rules. I can't state this enough. It's not people would say, oh, the Supreme Court doesn't have any rules. No, yes, they do. They have the same rules. It's just the enforcement rests with them.
Correct. And you know, I think from two different perspectives, that is ridiculous. One is sort of this old, like going back to Code of Hammurabi, you know, Nemo Iudex. I can't remember the exact, obviously the Code of Hammurabi wasn't written in Latin, but you know, there's this Latin phrase that says no man should be the judge in his own case. And so if you are trying to adjudicate your own ethical or consider your own ethical biases, you should not be the one determining whether you have bias in a case, right? If let's actually just use a better example. If Benny Thompson, the congressman from Jackson, Mississippi, right, it is Benny Thompson who's the January 6th, the chairman of January 6th, if he wanted to file a recusal motion, and he could have, and you know, he didn't, but if he wanted to file a recusal motion to Justice Thomas, say, hey, we have all these January 6th cases that are coming before the Supreme Court. You, Justice Thomas, are not biased in the January 6th cases because of your wife's involvement in trying to overturn the election. We think you should recuse. So he could file a motion, and only Justice Thomas would decide his level of bias to determine whether or not he could participate in the case. That is ridiculous. We are all terrible. And this is like social psych 101, terrible at determining our own biases. And that's why in the lower courts, you have these panels that can sort of help you talk through that. I mean, there's committees that the Judicial Conference, the policymaking body has, the Codes of Conduct Committee, Judicial Conduct and Disability Committee, Financial Disclosure Committee. But even if you mess up and you are participating in a case where you are biased, someone files a complaint and then that complaint is adjudicated. That process does not exist at the Supreme Court. It's only, you know, Benny goes to Clarence, Clarence says, nah, and then Clarence is one of nine justices on the case. Like, that's the whole process.
Yeah. Or another, you know, Senators Durbin and Whitehouse asked the Chief Justice to come before the court, which justices do, not before the court, before Congress. Justices do testify before Congress about budgetary.
Just, before we got on this call, I just happened to be served a video on YouTube of Scalia and Breyer testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2012, not that long ago.
They testified on before the Judiciary Committee. They testified with respect to their budget. They testify with respect to administrative matters. They are not allergic to a Supreme Court justice walking into the congressional building does not constitute a separation of powers problem. But it's a nifty excuse, separation of powers, that the Chief Justice has used by refusing to acknowledge or answer to Congress at all. And Congress does have the power to impose some rules. So let's talk about what Congress can do because the Supreme Court won't. But I want specifically your ideas about what works and how you know what works. And I want to go back a little bit to something you were talking to about with your early work on transparency. I remember that fight. It was a fight for so long for cameras in the Supreme Courtroom. If anyone listening has not been to the Supreme Court, it's a tiny building. Like when you get inside, the chamber is remarkably small. It fits a couple hundred people tops, including the reporters, including the lawyers, including the justices themselves, and any special guests. So to say that it is transparent just is inaccurate. Unless you go to Washington, stand in line, and maybe get a seat inside, you cannot see what's happening. You can't see the arguments taking place that will affect the lives of every American. And so for a long time, folks like Gabe pushed for that transparency, joined by media organizations like C-SPAN and others, to open the courts. And the justices, again, the decider, just consistently said no. And then this crazy thing called the pandemic happened, and they had to do arguments remotely, which was streamed live. And lo and behold, the sky didn't fall. And I thought, okay, once the pandemic is over, there's no way they can go back to the old way. And I was right. So the sky does seem to be falling when it comes to ethics, Gabe. So why haven't we seen the same kind of realization from the justices? Hey, we need to do something different here.
I think for a few reasons, and you know, I feel like I'm giving you multiple answers to each of your questions, but
it's okay.
But there are multiple answers. I think the justices, and especially Chief Justice Roberts, really wants unanimity here. He wants there to be all nine justices behind ethics proposal X. And it's very difficult to get all nine justices to agree on a specific proposal if it comes inside the building. Obviously, there are congressional efforts, which we can talk about.
Yeah, but Gabe, has he met Clarence Thomas? I mean, exactly. has he met Sam Alito?
But both of which have signed on both to the April 25th, 2023 Statement of Ethical Principles and Practices and the November 13th, 2023 Code of Conduct for the Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. So they have signed on to documents that sort of, you know, they're not new. And it says in the documents they're not new. They're just sort of reinforcing or restating their ethical responsibilities. But I think that's the best he can get out of the current nine. Now, this wasn't always the case. After the Abe Fortas scandal and a focus towards ethics in the late 60s, early 70s, Chief Justice Berger pushed for his colleagues to put out financial disclosure reports, even before it was a federal law. That federal law was signed in 78 and went into effect, I think, in 81. Justices would not fill out an entire report, but they would at least say how much money they made outside of their current jobs, because that was the whole Fortas scandal, was he was making $20,000 on top of his salary. That led him, and that, you know, Time magazine found out about it, and then he resigned. So, you know, not all the justices went along with it. It's possible, right, that some justices can do certain, have ethical practices, and even that's happening now. There are some justices, actually only two, Jackson and Kagan, that whenever they recuse, they'll tell you why they're recusing. Like, this is some, like, super, super basic thing that even was included in a Republican bill that was introduced in 2018, called the Judiciary Room Act, saying, you know, if you're a justice and you're recusing from a case or petition, which happens 200 times a year, maybe only a couple times from the actual cases that are argued, but out of 5,500 petitions, you get about 200 recusals. Just tell us why, right? You might not know your own biases, or you might forget your biases, or doing the process of saying, I am recusing because I own stock in Boeing, which happened earlier this year in Alito's case, you're just sort of recalling what your potential conflicts of interest are. That is a useful practice. And so,
and isn't that in the restatement that they all signed, that they would give a reason?
That they can, that they're open, that they're, you know, that was sort of the hedge language, unfortunately, that says justices may, if they choose, explain why they're disqualifying themselves from certain cases in petition. And first it was only Justice Kagan, and then Justice Jackson joined her. There's a question as to not or not whether Sotomayor is joining, because sometimes the three of them recuse together and there's but right now it's just two.
That's so interesting, because when I read that statement, I got out the statute that I've referred to now many times that covers all judges. And it's identical language, except the shalls are replaced by shoulds.
Yes.
And the musts are replaced by mays.
Yes. It is. That was like the first thing that, like,
it's literally verbatim with that only difference. And at that point, I'm like, you know what? I'm through. Like, nothing at all has changed. So I want to start talking about some solutions that have been proposed from across the gamut. Everything from impeaching current justices to overhauling the court in various ways. So I want to start with impeachment. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has filed impeachment motion against Clarence Thomas.
And Alito.
And Samuel Alito. Thank you. So do you think that is, or should be, you know, politics aside, a viable way to try to hold justices accountable for ethical lapses?
I don't. I tried to stop that from happening and was unsuccessful. I don't love the idea of, you know, reaching the conclusion without building the case. And yes, I know that ProPublica has built a case, and the Washington Post has built a case, and the New York Times has built a case, and I've found things and built various cases, but it hasn't happened in a sort of systematic, thoughtful way that, frankly, other investigations into judges and justices in the past have. You know, there's obviously hasn't been a lot of impeachment of the justices. Only one was impeached and not removed, and that was 200 years ago. But there have been lower court judges that have been impeached and removed for, let's say, you know, financial malfeasance or misconduct or what have you, where, you know, There are hearings, there's investigations, there are outside reports. There's a whole sort of steps, I think, that should be taking place before we sort of get to this conclusion of impeachment. And more things can come out along the way. So, like, starting with, you know, I'm using this as a metaphor and not actual thing, but starting with the death penalty and then sort of walking back and seeing, like, what the crimes are, to me just seems to put the cart before the horse. And I know that a lot of ethical malfeasance has occurred, but I think that, you know, there's sort of better ways to get this into the bloodstream and to think about it and to uncover the facts than sort of ending with the conclusion. And then, like, I guess, I don't know, if the Dems take the House, they'll have oversight hearings that'll build the facts. I'm not sure exactly what the TikTok of it all is, but that appears to be the thought.
I agree with everything that you just said. And I will also add,
I thought this was supposed to be conflict on podcasts. What's up with that?
Well, I'm adding something.
Okay, good.
I am adding that politically, I think that the tool of impeachment has been bludgeoned. It is just,
Is Mayorkas, right? Wasn't he impeached?
Yeah. I mean, it's just been ground into nothing, basically, primarily by the two impeachments without convictions against Donald Trump. And it is now seen not only by members of Congress, but also sadly by the public as a political tool, as a political weapon that really doesn't have a use. Now, this is, as also as a lawyer, really devastating because it was a very important constitutional mechanism. But I think that it has been just destroyed. And so I think the more it is used in a situation, as you said, where the case has not already been made, the more damaging it is, regardless of whether it's used by Democrats and Republicans. So I agree with you there. Now, I'm trying to go from like the most, you know, the biggest solution down to the maybe more pragmatic. So next up, packing the court. What do you think?
Yeah, also not a fan of that. I understand the desire to have, you know, let's say 13 justices, 7 of whom were appointed by Democratic presidents and 6 of whom were appointed by Republican presidents. So that could theoretically, if a case arose about, you know, abortion or climate, affirmative action, administrative state, you could flip it and go back to the way things were. I get that desire. I don't want to live in a juristocracy, though. First of all, I don't know if that is necessarily going to happen, that all of a sudden there are 13 justices and all of our problems are solved. You know, I just don't buy that argument. Number one. Number two, I don't want to live in a juristocracy. I don't want to live in a country where 13 or 15 or 17 or even 87 men and women in robes tell me how me and my family can live our lives. Like, I think that it should be, and it's, you know, a lot, it's hard work, but I think it should be the work of the people who decide where public policy should go. And, so to me, it's just sort of, you know, it's like this heuristic trick. It's like, oh, this one little trick that'll just get everything back. And it's just like, that's not, you know, first of all, historically, the Supreme Court has been reactionary. Like, you know, this is probably not the podcast for this, but it's like everyone just, you know, assumes that the Supreme Court, because they did Brown, and not everyone, but a lot of people assume because, you know, so the Supreme Court did Brown and Obergefell and some other, like, you know, progressive-ish type opinions over the last century, that it's, you know, not the reactionary behemoth it has always been. That's you know, there's a lot more Shelby Counties and Bush v. Gores and Citizens United than there are Browns. So, you know, I'm anti-juristocracy, and I think that court packing would only sort of get us to that point.
So I just love that I got a new word today, juristocracy. I'm not sure I knew that word existed. I'm glad that I know it exists. Now I want to get a T-shirt that says "Fight the Juristocracy," because I'm here with you. I you know, could you imagine in the year 2054 and all 250 members of the U.S. Supreme Court? Like, if you start packing the court, that's a political solution that I think would be unwieldy. So how about some form of term limit, senior status kind of situation? What do you think of that?
Well, since I've seen you at multiple term limits events in the last 6 months, I think you know where I sit. Look, this is something that, you know, when I started Fix the Court, this was not one of our fixes, because we did polling with, we actually used Donald Trump's pollster before Donald Trump was a politician, the McLaughlin Group, back in 2012, 13, 14. And, you know, we got the crosstabs back on term limits, and it was just like so much, it pulled so much higher on the right than on the left. And my desire was to create an organization where everything was like 70% plus. I mean, cameras was like 68 or something, but live streaming was like 72. But everything, you know, recusal reform, financial disclosure reform, knowing, you know, gift, all that stuff was 70 plus. And, you know, it was 70% plus on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side, it was maybe like 40 or 50. So I didn't want to, you know, have that fix be out there where it was only favoring one side. You know, after, and then after Obergefell came down in June of 2015, you had folks like Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Mike Huckabee, Ben Carson, on the campaign trail saying, you know, we want term limits or ending life tenure for the justices. They have too much power. And that was sort of a direct assault, on Obergefell. But that, you know, in parallel, I'd hired a different pollster, and they sort of found that there could be ways to get liberals behind term limits. As soon as I came out with it, everyone on the left that I knew was like, why are you trying to term limit Hillary's justices? Days of 2015. And I was like, that's not, I just,
people can only look at their short term interest, not correct. In the long, any court fix will have to be one, to quote a justice, for the ages.
Yes.
And it's difficult for people to see that.
And the real intellectual heft behind term limits didn't happen in 2014, 2015. It happened a decade prior when there was a symposium at Duke Law put on by one conservative and one Republican legal scholar talking about this moment where we had 10 years of no Supreme Court confirmations, right? Between Breyer and Roberts was like 11 years and a few months was the second longest time in U.S. history, almost longest, just a few weeks short, where there was no turnover in the, so that's really where the Supreme Court term limits arguments sort of crystallized. And I got to know some of the people who wrote for the symposium, and I got convinced in 2015, 2016, that was the thing to do. So I believe that 18-year term limits, which was the sort of the highlight paper from that written by the founder of the Federalist Society, a, you know, big liberal, as we know, I say sarcastically, 18-year term limits was really what came out of it. And people want to, And there's a way, to do 18-year term limits where you're not required to have a constitutional amendment. So in other words, as you alluded to in your question, it's prospective. So we wouldn't limit the tenures of any of the current nine, but future justices would only serve for 18 years, after which they'd be moved to senior status. And they can, like Justice Breyer is doing 2 weeks from now, hear cases in the lower courts, like Justice O'Connor did in every lower court, lower appeals court when she
Souter
was alive.
Did it. A lot of retired justices.
Souter,
exactly. That.
Souter's been doing it. So about half the justices who've retired since 1937 when the law was changed who allowed that have served on lower courts. And so
system is very similar to what happens in lower courts at the federal appellate and trial level. You have senior status justices where you were still. And the reason that we're talking about this and that this is a constitutional issue is because the Constitution says that federal appointments are for life. So you cannot then say, oh, no, it's not for life. It's just 18 years. That would violate, that would literally violate the Constitution. Yeah. But by keeping them in that status, they're still a justice. But it just changes what they're allowed to do. And it also, as a twofer, would give arguments to codify recusals, because one of the arguments against recusing is, oh, well, you can't have just eight justices because then you'll be in impossible deadlocks and it will change that. Well, first of all, we had eight justices for what, a year and some change when Merrick Garland's nomination was sat on ice and somehow the court functioned. But if you have senior status justices, they can also serve as a sit-in on a particular case if a justice has to recuse. So it solves so many problems.
Yes,
I'm giving a hint on what I think. But I have to say, at first I didn't like it. I didn't like term limits because, first of all, I think of term limits as a political tool, and the judiciary is by nature not supposed to be political. The reason that we had lifetime appointments, the founders reasoned, not unreasonably, it just didn't work out that way, that if you are not worried about being elected, if you're not worried about the whims of the people, popular opinion, then you can be fair. You don't worry that any decision that you make might end with your head. And that's why elected judges are a bad idea. You need to insulate them with lifetime appointments. And that I agreed with that. I continue to believe that elected judges on a state level are a bad idea. You should have people who are worried about the law, not worried about their next election. They're not worried about the political wins. But this has not worked because the political actors have found a way around lifetime appointments by, you know, jet setting and yachting and lining the pockets and buying trailers for and sending kids to school to try to influence the justices. So we need some other fix. I really came to this kicking and screaming, but it's the most realistic way that I know. And I want to ask you about one more thing before our time runs out. And that is what Senator Durbin seems to be suggesting now, saying, no. All this stuff is great, but we need to focus just on ethics reform. Like, just yes. Do that. Keep your eye on the prize. Forget all this, you know, term limity stuff and all this other stuff. Just ethics reform. Just make these justices do the things that we started out talking about. Disclosure, recusal. That's all. What do you think about that?
Yeah, look, he's been a great champion of the Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, which was a bill that, I mean, its genesis goes back, you know, 6 or 8 years and has bipartisan roots. But this version of it started about 3 or 4 years ago with Senator Whitehouse and Durbin and Hank Johnson and Jerry Nadler on the House side, just looking at basically the way that lower court judges and members of Congress deal with conflicts of interest and applying those to the justices of the Supreme Court. So, for example, in that bill, there's a line that says that the chief justice and the counselor to the chief justice, basically the chief of staff, shall create a set of gift, travel, and disclosure rules that are at least as strict as those for the members of the House and Senate. It includes recusal provisions, adding to the current recusal law that talks about, you know, not just your entanglements, but also the entanglements of, you know, your spouse and other members of your family. It says that if you get a gift from somebody, you know, just like their revolving door rules for the House and the Senate, and there's a cooling off period, it would institute a cooling off period. So, you know, even if, you know, you have these strict gift rules, even if somehow you got a gift through a loophole or whatever, and that person who gave you a gift had a case before you, you couldn't participate in a case for, I think we settled on 6 years. I'd be fine with 2 years, but, you know, 6 years of cooling off period between the time you received that gift and you could, and when you could hear a case involving the gift giver. So it's really just looking at the existing federal code and the rules of the House and the Senate and saying, you know, what's missing here? What doesn't line up? So I think that's what, you know, part of what he's looking at. And the second part of that bill is a way to bring complaints against the justices of the Supreme Court. Currently, the complaint process for the lower courts is any person can file a complaint against a judge in a lower court, and there are 2,300 of them, and there are about 1,400 judges, and there's 1,400 complaints a year, and about 1,380 of them are dismissed because they're frivolous or about litigation, which you can't complain about. Like, you can appeal, but you can't complain about litigation. And so the 20 or so that are meritorious get adjudicated and reviewed and what have you. And that process does not exist at the Supreme Court, but the bill that Senator Durbin is focusing on would create a process. There'd be reporting requirements, there'd be investigation requirements. And so the few times a year that the justices mess up, you know, there would be a way to sort of, you know, publicly shame them into doing the right thing. Yeah. And I think that that's an important way to hold them to account.
So finally, Gabe, how do we get there? What is the impediment to enacting something like this? And listen, I know that we always say, oh, well, Congress is feckless and they can't work. If there's a pressing issue, we've seen Congress work. We saw after January 6th, Congress got together and on a bipartisan basis amended the Electoral Count Act to stop this kind of shenanigans from happening again. We saw members of Congress react during a pandemic to keep, you know, kids from starving. Why can't in this moment, when the Supreme Court is clearly broken and what goes around comes around, what will it take to get lawmakers to get this on the desk of the President Biden has said he'd sign it. So what does it take to get it on that desk?
Well, I don't think it'll be President Biden at this point. I think we're sort of, you know, lame duck and moving on, you know, just being
or any
honest,
president, you know, or, you know, and if this should be bipartisan, this should be beyond politics. So what can listeners do if they are tired and fed up with the Supreme Court as it is now to push for a change?
Yeah, I mean, beyond the sort of, yeah, like you said, beyond the sort of obvious is, you know, electing members of Congress that support strong ethics reform laws. I think there are a few things. One is, you know, we don't think of them as constituents, but are having constituents. But everyone in America lives in one of 94 federal judicial districts and one of 13 U.S. courts of appeal. Well, D.C. is sort of different, so we'll keep it at 13, even though the federal circuit and the D.C. circuit are a little bit different by nature.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what I want to do is I want to have more judges speaking out against the ridiculousness of the judiciary, of the Supreme Court not following basic ethics rules. I think, you know, I don't care if, you know, someone from the AO reaches out and says, Gabe, don't tell people to do this, but write your chief judge, right? Look, Google who your chief judge is in the Southern District of Texas or the Northern District of New York or the Western District of Washington and say, you know, you should, you know, they all have email addresses. It's easy to find on the internet. And, you know, I want more judges speaking out, because I think if the Supreme Court felt heat from their fellow jurists, I think that would compel some of them to move and change their ways and be a little bit more accepting of ethics enforcement rules. So I think that's number one. Number two is, if you have a member of Congress who sits on the House or Senate Financial Services and General Government Subcommittee, I know that's a mouthful, FSGG for short, you can have them. And this, because this is the subcommittee that oversees the judiciary's budget, you can have them, like Senator Van Hollen did last year, propose an amendment that says, until you, the Supreme Court, adopt an enforceable code of conduct, we're going to withhold $10 million of your non-security budget. So the justices get about $150 million taxpayer money each year. $4 million is required for salaries. About $50 to $75 million is required for security. So otherwise, they got about $75 or $100 million left. Let's rescind some of that money. Hey, you don't want enforcement ethics, SCOTUS? You don't have four clerks anymore. You know, I think using the power of the purse.
Is that constitutional? Is that constitutional? All right, I'm not sure that that's absolutely the case. I think that's when you start dabbling into the separation of powers problem.
The Supreme Court does not have carte blanche to have, you know, working fireplaces, catered lunches, four clerks writing their first drafts of their opinions. I don't think, you know, look, Supreme Court security is sacrosanct. Like, I don't need to talk about, you know, the recent Sotomayor and Kavanaugh threats. Like, that is.
And we need the court to function, you know,
but they could do so with fewer judicial assistants and fewer parties hosted in the Great Hall.
All right.
Who was paying for, was it this, did, you know, when Justice Jackson gave that talk to the Supreme Court Historical Society in the Great Hall? Like, the Supreme Court Historical Society paid for, like, the past hors d'oeuvres, but the Supreme Court paid for the lights to be on, the access to the courtroom, the extra security, et cetera. So, you know, or the extra janitors or whatever. So, you know, to me, it's one of these things where I don't think they need all of their money. And if they want all of their money, then they should have enforceable ethics. Right. And, you know, the last thing is just look at what your state courts do, right? If you live in Colorado, you have the Colorado Judicial Commission, where you can have complaints against justices adjudicated by a nonpartisan, non-political, non-judicial panel. And so there are ways, other, you know, the state courts have solved a lot of the issues that we see in the federal courts already. And this idea that, you know, you can't borrow the best from the states and apply it to the feds is ridiculous, because of course I think you can.
Yeah. I also wonder if that last solution also will run into some constitutional separation of powers.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can have someone, you can create somebody within the judiciary.
Yes.
But I think the idea that you can have this independent body adjudicating the SCOTUS, I think that wouldn't even, you know, that wouldn't pass the constitutional giggle
test. Depending on what the result is, right? Mm. You know, I don't think you could have them pushing a justice off for recusal, but I think there are ways to sanction the justices by, say, a panel of senior judges, like Justice Kagan suggested at her Ninth Circuit talk in July. I think there's a way to do that, and, you know, legislative language coming to an inbox near you soon. But, you know, I think overall, you know, a lot of the enforcement mechanisms are, you know, shame, reports, you know, that sort of
shame.
Thing, which, you know, hopefully will work.
Bring back the power of shame.
Yes.
Gabe Roth, thank you so much for joining me on Justice by Design. This is such an important conversation as we get ready for yet another term that has a lot of consequential cases on the docket. Thanks, Gabe.
Thanks.
So I share Gabe's concern about the Supreme Court and its credibility and the desire to see something done. I have a few other thoughts. I'm not sure judges will care if people will call them up and complain. I'm not sure Other judges are going to be willing to call out the SCOTUS, although I think that they should. And I think that it's important. We've seen people like Judge Michael Luttig, a very respected conservative judge for his entire career, come out and be critical of cases involving, you know, things like immunity for presidents. So it's possible, but I feel like really the power to change the Supreme Court to enforce ethics rules is in the hands of the people. But that can only happen if our leaders keep pushing the point about how important it is. As we record this, there have been 3 days of the Democratic National Convention. And only once did I see the Supreme Court expressly mentioned. It was by Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, who held up her hand and said, you know, you want to attack gay marriage, you'll have to pry my wedding ban from my cold, dead gay hand. And that really put into perspective the fact that things like marriage equality is not a guarantee. I mean, she was making the point that Kamala Harris, as an attorney general, declined to defend California's gay marriage ban, and that pushed the case to the Supreme Court, which led to the Obergefell decision that granted constitutional protection for same-sex marriages from coast to coast. Kamala Harris played a key role in that and knows better than most the importance of the Supreme Court. So why aren't people talking just directly about the Supreme Court? The next president will nominate at least one Supreme Court justice. And depending on who the president is, it could be even more. Could you imagine Donald Trump, who has given us that 6-3 super conservative majority, getting back in the position to nominate more, either replacing existing conservatives with even younger people who will have an even longer impact, or forbid, heaven forbid, one of the Democratic appointees giving the court a 7-2 conservative bet? Do you know what would happen to basic freedoms then? I'm speaking politically now. My friend Gabe could not. He is a nonpartisan actor. He's just trying to see the court work better. I'm trying to see the court work better too, but for a reason, to better protect our rights, you know, to actually do equal justice under law, which is written on the building. And we've seen that not happen when the court's majority is lopsided. And we've also seen the refusal to adopt and adhere by ethics violation because the court is lopsided. If it were more evenly divided, there would be more compromise even on that issue. So the Supreme Court and its ethics is on every single ballot, the presidential, the Senate, the House. We need everybody to vote for candidates who believe, just like I do, just like Gabe does, that ethics and a functioning Supreme Court is essential for our democracy. And vote like it. Supreme Court's on the ballot. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Thank you for joining me for Justice by Design. Don't forget to follow, subscribe, like, give 5 stars. We really want to grow this podcast and would love to do that, but we need your help to do it. And I do hope you like what you hear and that you come back every week and follow me here. In the meantime, see you next time.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.